about doing this, and I generally don't do animal welfare type interviews in Steve Dale's Other World podcast. I saved that for my pet podcast and the radio show that I have on WGN about pets, the national radio I do about companion animals as well. But I wanted to spend a bit more time with this man, Wayne Pacelli, the CEO, president of the Humane Society of the United States, who has influenced and impacted so many people who have followed. I mean, you are a cheerleader. You are a man who has made so many changes in so many lives that at the end of the day has impacted the way we feel as a society about companion animals. And I am so grateful for that. Wayne, I'm pleased, honored to have you here.
Well, it's my honor. Thank you very much for those generous words, Steve.
And I mean what I say. The name of your latest book, which we'll get to in a moment, called The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. But before I get there, do you think that the Humane Society of the United States is misunderstood by some people who want to do the right thing for animals too, but for whatever reason or combination of reasons, misunderstand or maybe are misinformed about the HSUS?
No question about it. I mean, we as a high-profile organization that takes on tough issues really get branded by a lot of folks in different ways. And some people have an honest sort of lack of understanding about what we do, because frankly, our work is complex. We're really about protecting all animals, dogs, cats, horses, farm animals, animals in research, wildlife. It takes us into 200 different campaigns. We do a huge amount of direct care work for animals, but we also do public policy work and corporate affairs work. It's actually quite a complicated enterprise, and it's difficult for someone with a cursory touch with our work to really grasp the depth and breadth of our work. Now, there are some folks who are trying to define us in a negative way because they don't like some aspects of our agenda. This is mainly groups that don't like us taking on puppy mills, or don't like us taking on factory farming, or don't like us taking on the seal hunt, or don't like us taking on horse slaughter. They're threatened by HSUS. And one way that people respond to a threat is to attack the messenger. They may not be able to kind of win the argument on horse slaughter or puppy mills or factory farming, or they may not think that that's the best way to attack the challenge that they're receiving. So in response, they go after HSUS. They say HSUS should just be sending money to animal shelters. That's really what it's about. And HSUS is mischaracterizing itself and is duping the public. A lot of people give to the organization thinking that HSUS gives grants to shelters. You know, it's very, very legitimate for a national organization to give grants to shelters. I mean, I think that's fabulous. And we actually do give millions in dollars of grants to animal shelters, as well as to wildlife rehab centers and big cat sanctuaries and other animal care operations. But we're not a foundation. We never characterized our work as a grant-making exercise exclusively. We've got 1,000 employees. We're doing direct care work ourselves, so we don't have to give grants to a separate organization to then conduct animal care work. We can do it directly. Plus, our work is much broader than that. We value animal rescue work and animal sheltering work so meaningfully, but that's just part of our enterprise. I mean, we're trying to change the laws for animals. We're trying to change the way corporations behave. That means preventing cruelty, and it means really tangling with agribusiness and the trophy hunting lobby and the puppy mill industry. And I think a lot of the people who say, oh, HSUS should just be giving grants to animal shelters, they actually know better. They just don't want us to spend in these other areas because they happen to have a financial stake in retaining the status quo.
I understand all that. So let me go a step further. I was talking to someone, I'm not going to tell you who, but a well-known person in this particular world who said that the HSUS
You know what, Wayne? Before I ask you, let me ask you another question. Do you eat?
Yes.
All right.
Do I eat? Yes, indeed. Okay. Okay. I think all of us.
Okay, hold on. Hold on. Is that something he's never been asked before, you think? All right, hold on. You'll hear why I ask that. So he said that, and he said, Wayne Pacelli in particular, wants to end all farming in America. Now, at a logical level, it makes sense. But this is a very high-profile person who said, and he was talking about individual farmers specifically. So I want to ask you straight out, do you have any agenda at all that you want to end farming by family farmers in America?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely not. And, you know, it's more than just a rhetorical denial. We put this principle into practice. We've got 11 agriculture councils at HSUS, different states, Wisconsin, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, other states, Colorado. These are working farmers and ranchers who are HSUS members who are volunteer leaders within our organization speaking about family farming, speaking about animal husbandry and humane stewardship, properly caring for animals in agriculture, really as a counterpoint or a countervailing force to corporate-controlled industrial agriculture, which treats animals too often like meat, milk, and egg-producing machines. So it's not enough for me to say that's a false argument. I want to, you know, really get granular, Steve, and I want to mention that we invest in family farmers. We actively support family farmers. This is not some passive or grudging, you know, acknowledgement that they're part of America and that, you know, we prefer them over the industrial farmers and that, you know, if we've got to choose one, we'll take the family farmers. No, this is active promotional support for family farmers and their means of, you know, trying to give the animals as good a life as possible with the understanding that, yes, they're going to be used in our food production system, they're going to be slaughtered. But this is a caricature of HSUS that really relates and emanates from the, you know, the pork industry and the egg laying industry, where we've been fighting with these industries, and they really take an extreme view of HSUS to try to marginalize us, and then, you know, otherwise good people get caught up in this and somehow believe it and then repeat it. And, you know, Mark Twain said, you know, a lie's halfway around the world while the truth is still trying to get his pants on. And I think that's what's happening to HSUS with some class of people.
Well, and I wanted you to have an opportunity to talk about these sorts of things. And another thing that I've heard is that HSUS has an agenda where your goal is to have, and I know you personally, and I'll say it, and I suspect you would say it publicly too, you're a vegetarian. My wife, in fact, is a vegetarian. I am not. It's an individual choice that people make. And that your goal is to have everyone be a vegetarian. Is that true?
Well, again, I mean, our active support for family farmers who are raising cattle and pigs and chickens, I think, is kind of the best rejoinder to this characterization of our work. I am actually a vegan. I've been a vegan for more than 30 years. Mm-hmm. But our board chairman is an omnivore, and we've got a very diverse staff and volunteer leadership. You know, I mentioned all these farmers who are part of our leadership. We don't have an orthodox view on this issue. We're a heterodox organization when it comes to the raising of animals for food. We celebrate the vegans and the vegetarians. We celebrate the fact that people want to make a great commitment and that they eat a plant-based diet. But we also celebrate the people who are making conscious choices to eat more humanely raised animal products. And we celebrate the farmers who are showing a pathway there. So there's a, you know, a view of the world that everything's black and white. You're either for something, you know, in very stark terms, or you're not. And our view is just more nuanced. It's diverse. It's a pluralist sort of view of the world. It's a recognition that meat and other animal products have been part of the human diet for hundreds of thousands of years, that it's been a big part of who we are. That's not going to be unwound overnight, even if HSUS or other animal groups said so. And, you know, we want people to make tangible steps in the right direction. People decide we're going to buy cage-free eggs rather than eggs from hens kept in confinement, we celebrate that. If people want to do Meatless Monday and abstain from eating animal products one day a week, which if that were taken on a national scale would save more than a billion animals a year from food production, we celebrate that. If people say, listen, I want to have grass-fed beef rather than beef from cattle who are raised in a feedlot, we celebrate that. So it's really more about progress than it is perfection, and it's about taking tangible steps to enhance animal welfare.
And isn't some of this progress, some of what you describe, first of all, from the medical community, demonstrated to be healthier for us, if we can eat healthier, and some of what you described might even benefit us as consumers in that way, but also benefit our economy, which is something you write about very directly in the Humane Economy Animal Protection 2.0.
Yes, yeah, so without question. I mean, it was more than 40 years ago that Francis Moore LePay, the author who wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet, called animals, farm animals, protein factories in reverse. They take large inputs of plant foods, mainly row crops, and turn those corn and soybeans and other plant foods into a small amount of animal protein. And you can look at the different ratios. So 12 or 13 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef, 7 or 8 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of pork, 4 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of chicken. That is an inefficient use of those resources. That means that 80% of the corn and soybeans that we grow in the Midwest, in this country, in Illinois, in Indiana, in Iowa, those foods are going to animals. There are also issues of the waste that the animals, you know, as a biological process, release into the environment. You know, 320 million Americans produce waste, but our waste goes to treatment plants, and that waste is denuded of its toxic qualities. For the 9 billion animals raised for food, none of that waste is treated. It's going onto fields. It's going into our water. There are big collateral costs to industrial agriculture, and I think what I talk about in the Humane Economy is really kind of a greater level of transparency and a full accounting of what's going on here. The health consequences of a diet that is too rich in animal protein that causes cancers and heart disease, the overuse of antibiotics, which is producing antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which are a threat to our public health system and can lead us into a post-antibiotic era, the massive manure loads that come from these concentrated animal feeding operations, the inefficient use of water and grains in a world that is finite, where we really need to be careful about how we're using these finite resources. All of these go into our narrative as we have a discussion about animal agriculture and talk about, you know, how we people can be conscious consumers and make better choices. It doesn't mean exclusive vegetarianism or veganism. It means consciously thinking about these things and taking even small steps to do better.
I can change the subject a little bit and talk about purebred dogs. So those who breed dogs, I don't think they love you. And the presumption is that the HSUS wants to destroy all dog breeding. Again, what's true there and what isn't? What seems to be true, and I think everyone's on the same page, if you love dogs, you want to save dogs. You want to help dogs. So what is fact and what isn't?
We celebrate the place that dogs and cats as domesticated animals have in our lives. I mean, two different categories of domesticated animals who have been in close association with humans for thousands of years. They bring us so many benefits. We bring benefits to them. But we need to responsibly manage the populations. I mean, we as a nation have failed in some respects because, you know, you look in the 1970s, we were euthanizing 15 million plus dogs and cats in shelters in the United States because we were not engaging in responsible care of these animals. We weren't limiting populations to conform those populations to the available number of homes. We were breeding too much, too often. and not doing enough to promote adoption. So through the work of the humane movement, through so much of the work, Steve, that you have done and other leaders in animal welfare, promoting adoption, promoting spaying and neutering, promoting the idea that we need to be careful caretakers of these domesticated animals who we domesticated to bring into our world, so there's a responsibility that comes with that history. Now the number of animals euthanized is down to about 2.5 million, still too much. But there are some folks who don't like our agenda who may say, oh, look, they're talking about spaying and neuter. They want to stop us from breeding at all. No. I mean, when we succeed in eliminating the euthanasia of healthy dogs and cats, we're going to need breeding in order to fulfill the demand that people have to bring dogs and cats into their homes and into their lives. We don't want that to end. We want to celebrate that human-animal bond, that connection that we have with other creatures. It's mutualism. It is a great example of a responsible, pattern of behavior with animals. But again, if you want to caricature, not you, but collectively the you, if you're a puppy mill operator, or if you don't like HSUS for one reason or another, you say, okay, well, HSUS, they want to stop all breeding. They want to end purebred dogs. No, that's not the case. We do want purebred dogs to be healthier. We don't like many of these conformation standards that exist for certain purebreds that value their external characteristics, like the length of their snout or the length of their back or the size of their or shape of their hips. We don't like that when it undermines the underlying bodily integrity and health of the animal. And we've been critics of groups like the American Kennel Club and some of the other breed registries for perpetuating these breed standards that really do produce unhealthy animals who have chronic problems that then, you know, if you're a responsible caretaker of these animals, it's going to be bigger vet bills, it's going to be shortened lifespans, it's going to be more grieving for you as a pet owner.
Yeah, and something that you and I maybe can work on, specifically on the cat side. So on the dog side, there's tail docking and there's ear cropping, significant issues. I think perhaps even more significant, because it's barbaric, it's an amputation when cats are declawed. And I know you agree with that. I just would like to take the next step forward to do something about it. So if I tomorrow wanted to say, hey, Wayne, I cannot find a rescue group that will provide an Irish setter. Or I don't even want to go to a rescue group. I want an Irish setter puppy. If I go to a responsible breeder, do you have a problem with that?
I don't. I mean, we prefer that people go to a rescue group or a shelter, as you say. But if it's not in the cards, then there's no ethical problem with the responsible reproduction of puppies. I mean, obviously, we want there not to be inbreeding. We don't want, characteristics in the animals that stem from, some of these conformation standards. It's going to compromise the animal's health. But if the animal is healthy, the act of breeding and reproduction, you know, is not an act of inhumane treatment or cruelty. It's as natural as human reproduction.
Well, and, you know, I think that a lot of people like a purebred dog. I mean, that seems clear. That's fine by me. The problem is, how do you define a responsible breeder? And that definition, if I ask 10 people in the dog world, whether they be veterinarians or maybe a breeder or maybe someone who works at the American Kennel Club or maybe someone who works at the Humane Society of the United States, I'm going to get 10 different answers.
Yeah, we do have a section on our website on what a responsible breeder is. So someone can Google Humane Society responsible breeding and see, you know, what we say. And one of the first things we say is that responsible dog breeders can play a vital role in the effort to help stop puppy mills by offering perspective and guidance on the proper way to care for breeding dogs and puppies and educating prospective buyers about the importance of humane care. So responsible breeders are actually the alternative you know, one of the alternatives to the puppy mills and this larger problem that we're trying to confront.
Aha! So that was my next question. So in this nation, where 90%, depending on the poll you look at, of pet owners consider pets members of their families, where half of the people literally who have a dog share their beds with their dogs, cats, increasingly, they're kept indoors. As for where the cat sleeps, that's pretty much up to the cat. But they are kept indoors increasingly and loved, just loved. In this country where we buy gold, literally gold-plated collars for our dogs at times, and where they go out in the cold and they wear a winter coat, I mean, where all of these wonderful things are happening, how can it be the puppy mills still exist?
It's one of the real conundrums of the modern animal protection movement because, you know, few issues have had the level of attention and discourse and media attention that puppy mills have had. I think it's explained partly because puppy mills essentially are large-scale dog breeding operations that cut corners in order to, you know, churn out puppies for the pet trade and make a profit. And many of the puppy mills that now operate are folks who used to be in the livestock business. They were pig breeders who went out of business. In the 1970s, there were 700,000 pig farms in the U.S. Now there are fewer than 70,000. So 630,000 people who were involved in pig farming went out of business. A small percentage of those people picked up puppies as an alternative form of agriculture. The same is true with the dairy industry. The same is true with the poultry industry, the egg industry. People adopted this agricultural mindset to puppy production, and there is a keen connection to agriculture, and there's already a major existing defense apparatus for agriculture. So the Farm Bureau and the pork industry and others defend puppy mills. So when we try to crack down on these operations at the state level or the federal level, we get fierce resistance from the farm lobby, which is a powerful enterprise and a powerful lobbying force in the United States. I think that is largely the political explanation for how puppy mills continue to operate. Now, you know, my book, The Humane Economy, talks about how informed consumers are driving the marketplace, how Walmart and McDonald's and so many other companies that we've negotiated agreements with are now going to be sourcing animal products from more humane farming operations. That is an incredible example of the power of the marketplace, the power of transparency, information, people taking that information and driving better outcomes in our society. The strange thing is, why don't we have this circumstance with puppy mills? And, you know, we're making progress. 150 locales, including Cook County, have restrictions on selling dogs from pet stores now. We're starting to see more state laws. There's a federal rulemaking petition to the U.S. Department of Agriculture on having humane breeding standards at the federal level, which would essentially mean more humane breeding standards for the puppy mills that exist. So things are changing, but, you know, one of the big problems with animal protection is that people are disassociated from the underlying mistreatment of the animal. So you see a puppy in a pet store or you acquire one through an internet site, and it's very difficult for the average consumer to unwind that scenario and really see what the backstory of how that animal was treated in Arkansas or Oklahoma or Iowa. We at HSUS have been to hundreds and hundreds of these puppy mills. We've raided them when the situation is so bad that it becomes a cruelty case, and we work with law enforcement to intervene and often seize the animals, again, with the consent of law enforcement. We know the real backstory. We see what happens because we've done these in just about every state that has mills. But the public still is struggling with the details and not making all the connections. We're trying very hard to educate people to make those connections so we can shrink this industry.
And I think that a couple things. First of all, I think that people sometimes make the connection. They want to save the animal. So they're thinking that by saving the animal, they're doing the right thing. And they kind of are, maybe for that individual animal. But for the bigger picture, it's just another sale to the puppy mill. And the other thing is online.
Great point.
Online, it's so confusing. So, I mean, these people have gotten smart, and they answer the questions the way people like you and me say, okay, ask these questions and expect these answers. Well, the puppy mills hear me and you, and they answer the questions the way they're supposed to be answered, though it's not the truth. And online, unless you're seeing the facility, unless you're meeting those animals, but people don't. They fall in love with an image, and sometimes it's a very legitimate group, either a rescue group, a shelter, and it's the right thing to do, but sometimes it's not. And discerning online what is and what isn't can be very, very challenging. And even if it's clear that it's not, according to those that enforce the law that I've talked to, they say, well, it's hard to enforce that a law because it's the Wild West out there online, and there isn't much that even law enforcement can do about it, even if everyone knows it's a bad guy that's selling these animals.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And this is, again, a big theme I talk about in my book is imperfect information leading to imperfect outcomes for animals. In this world now, the information age, with so many outlets to gather information, we're becoming much more informed across the board. That's why Ringling Brothers has given up its elephants, why SeaWorld has ended the breeding of orcas, why the biggest food retailers are now saying they're going to go cage-free or crate-free. It's why the Congress just adopted a new federal standard for chemical testing to make animal testing the last resort rather than the first sort of experimental or testing response. I mean, the world is changing for animals across the board, but it remains a continuing challenge. And there are political defenders of animal exploitation and cruelty. Again, the very same people who miscast and mischaracterized the work of HSUS, they are fighting to continue what's going on, and they're trading on the lack of knowledge that a lot of people have about the backstory of animals, and that's why puppy mills continue to survive.
Yeah. The name of the book is called The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0, which really, at the end of the day, I think in one sentence, and I'll let you jump in there and add in, we all benefit. It turns out, our wallets benefit. We feel better, maybe. Maybe it's the right thing to do. Maybe it's the humane thing to do. But it actually improves our economy, it turns out, by doing the humane thing.
Well, I think essentially, you know, my argument is, and you've articulated it well there, Steve, is any business grounded on animal cruelty or exploitation is in trouble with an informed base of consumers. And we now know too much about the intelligence of animals, the cognitive capacities of animals, the family lives, the social lives of animals. We can no longer be in denial that these animals think and feel and have a lot of complexity in their head. And if we really believe that animal cruelty is wrong, it asks something of us. And more consumers are taking those actions and demanding that businesses embrace animal protection. You know, a company like SeaWorld, where there was so much criticism on the treatment of the orcas, was not going to survive if it didn't make adjustments in its business model. Walmart may have survived, but they said, why do we want the brand risk of being associated with an extreme form of confinement of animals on factory farms when we can just as soon, you know, opt for cage-free and crate-free production systems that supply us, and, you know, we'll appeal to everybody. I mean, no one should want to see any animal abuse. So when you squeeze the abuse out of the supply chain or out of the conduct of the business, you enable the company to appeal to everyone versus half the public that might not be too concerned about animal cruelty, but the other half of the public is deeply concerned, and that's a brand risk to that company.
Well, very well put. Again, The Humane Economy is the name of the book. This is Wayne Pacelli, the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. Wayne, my problem is, even though it's a podcast, I still have to cut it somewhere. Otherwise, I think we could go, you and I, 7 or 8 days and keep talking. And maybe we will one day. I don't know. We'll have you on again at some point in time. You know the admiration I have for you. And with that, I just say two words, I suppose. Thank you.
Listen, I thank you for your incredible advocacy for animals for so many years. We're all partners in this enterprise of building a humane society.
Yep. I mean, at times, and I'll say this because I need to on the radio, you and I haven't always agreed. Sometimes publicly we haven't always agreed. But, man, the admiration has never wavered. And congratulations on the book and, again, on all the work you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. Really appreciate it.